Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, as leaders of the world's richest nations gather for the opening of the G8 summit in Germany, Pope Benedict urges them to keep poverty alleviation at the top of the political agenda. Meanwhile, here in the Vatican, hundreds of delegates at the Caritas Internationalis General Assembly discuss those same concerns of poverty, development and environmental protection. They too send an urgent message to world leaders to live up to their promises to the poor. Welcome to the programme. Do not go back on your promises to the world's poorest people, especially on the African continent. That was the clear message that Pope Benedict XVI had for leaders of the G8 nations meeting in Heiligendamm, Germany this week. The Pope's words came during his general audience with pilgrims and visitors in St. Peter's Square on Wednesday, spelling out clearly the need for a substantial increase in development aid from the G8 nations. The Pope called for a special focus on achieving universal primary education by the year 2015. My colleague Charles Collins takes a closer look.
Lo scorso 16 dicembre ebbe occasione di scrivere.
Pope Benedict recalled an exchange of letters last winter with the summit's host, German Chancellor Angela Merkel. The Holy Father said that he thanked the German leader in the name of the Catholic Church for the decision to keep the theme of world poverty on the agenda of the G8, with specific reference to Africa. He said that Dr. Merkel had assured him of the G8's commitment to attaining the Millennium Development Goals for easing the suffering on the continent.
Speciale attenzione merita il secondo grande obiettivo del millennio, il raggiungimento dell'educazione primaria per tutti.
In his appeal, the Pope made special mention of one of the Millennium Goals, to achieve universal primary education, that is, to ensure that all boys and girls complete a full course of primary schooling by 2015. The Holy Father said this is an integral part of the attainment of all the other Millennium Goals. He also reminded the G8 leaders that the Catholic Church has always been at the forefront in the field of education, reaching places, particularly in the poorest countries, that the state structures often fail to reach. The Pope said that according to the principle of subsidiarity, this reality should be recognized, valued, and supported by governments and international organizations, among other things by the allocation of sufficient funding, so that greater efficacy may be guaranteed in the attainment of the Millennium Development Goals. Before making his appeal, he continued his reflections on the early figures of the Church to the crowd of over 30,000 people.
In our catechism, the Fathers of the Early Church, we now turn to St. Cyprian. A convert from paganism, Cyprian became the Bishop of Carthage and guided the Church in Africa through the persecution of the Emperor Decius and its aftermath. He showed firmness and pastoral sensitivity in readmitting after due penance those Christians who had lapsed during the persecution, and he worked strenuously for the spiritual and moral renewal of the community. His many writings closely linked to his ministry as bishop stress the unity of Christ's Church, founded on Peter, and was perfectly realized in the sacrament of the Eucharist.
And my thanks to Charles Collins for that report on Pope Benedict's weekly general audience. A tale of two summits. That's how the Global Confederation of Catholic Aid and Development Agencies, Caritas Internationalis, is viewing the G8 meeting in Germany alongside its own General Assembly taking place here in the Vatican. In Germany, leaders of the eight richest nations are debating how to spend billions of dollars on investments, poverty reduction, and combating climate change. At the Caritas meeting, delegates from over 160 national aid and development agencies are reviewing their vast network of grassroots initiatives focused on those same goals of poverty and environmental protection. At first sight, there may not seem to be much in common between the high-security, high-profile meeting of leaders from France, Germany, Britain, Italy, the US, Canada, Japan and Russia in Heiligendamm and the easily accessible gathering of charity workers here in the Vatican Synod Hall. But one of the key focuses of this week's Caritas meeting is to keep the pressure on the G8 leaders and urge them to deliver on their unfulfilled promises to the poorest nations.
We're all going to be demanding the same thing, keep your promises.
Chris Bain is director of CAFOD, the London-based aid agency of the Catholic bishops in England and Wales.
In 2000, the world community, the global community, the leaders of the world committed themselves to the Millennium Development Goals. And the Holy See were right in there supporting these goals to halve world poverty and to increase education and health. The problem is they didn't will the means to deliver that. They didn't really will the aid. And so 5 years ago in Gleneagles, when the G8 were meeting, and indeed in the European meetings before that, we were all really campaigning to make sure that the politicians kept their promise on aid. And they did in promises. They promised to increase aid from $75 billion a year for another $50 billion by 2010. They promised to cut debt relief on many of the poorest countries, the 18 poorest countries. They didn't do anything on trade. That seems to be just kicked into the long grass at the moment. The problem is, 2 years later, that we're not seeing those promises being fulfilled. America and Italy have cut their budgets. France and Germany are pretty stable. The British government, to their credit, have increased their aid commitment. So the message must be, keep your promises, keep this aid flowing, keep trying to build and work for the Millennium Development Goals. And that really has got to be a strong message of this Assembly.
The message is going to be made very public, isn't it, as you gather with a huge great banner in St. Peter's Square beneath the great dome of St. Peter's. Do you think this kind of public shaming, if you like, the leaders into taking action, does this work at all, do you think?
Yes, I think it does. It's going to be an immensely visual image of the banner of 400 delegates from the Assembly, from the Catholic Church, development and welfare agencies all over the world. And we're all going to be demanding the same thing, keep your promises. And we're going to send that photograph to the leaders. We're going to make sure it goes through Tony Blair and Angela Merkel, whom the Pope recently sent a letter to. So yes, we hope it will have an impact. It'll go through the Catholic press worldwide as well, hopefully, and the leaders will have to listen.
Beyond this very public demand, you're also working very hard, aren't you, behind the scenes? Tell us a bit more about the other strategies that you're trying to pursue in order to really get the money where the leaders' mouths are.
I think that behind the scenes there are two things going on here. One is carrying on the issues on trade and debt and aid, that's fine. But the other issue within the Caritas Federation is that at the moment we're, in terms of numbers and sort of resources and input, the second largest humanitarian agency in the world after the Red Cross. But no one knows about this in the world. No one understands that the Catholic Church's combined resources are such huge. And it's because we're not coordinated. It's because actually we don't really work together as well as we should. It's because we don't work with the local church on the ground as well as we should. And I think one of the things emerging from this Assembly is an exciting framework for humanitarian action, which gives us a competence no other agency has. We are there because of our church structures before any emergency happens. They're there in the parishes and the dioceses. We're there during the whole weight of the Confederation, and we're always there afterwards. We don't just go when the money runs out. That's an immense, immense sort of treasure that we have as an organisation, as a network of Catholic agencies, and we've got to make sure that really works. So that means we've got to be more professional. It means we've got to have codes of conduct. It means we've got to communicate more through people like yourselves about the richness and the scale and scope of Caritas work worldwide.
You're moving, as you say, into a field where professionalism has to be the watchword. Is there a risk, though, as you're working on these codes of conduct and so on, that you perhaps lose sight of the basic spiritual mission of Caritas?
There is a risk, and that means we must root our work. I think the encyclical last year, Deus Caritas Est, reminded us that for all the professionalism, we must root ourselves in the parable of the Good Samaritan, in the whole, the fact that charity and love are central to our work and that God is at the centre of that. Yes, there is a risk, and we will do everything we can to ensure that the Federation recognises it's not just its church roots, but its spiritual roots, that we are doing God's work.
Chris Bain is director of the London-based Catholic Agency for Overseas Development. Alongside the vital advocacy role played by Caritas at international level, the Confederation is reviewing its work in the three other key areas: responding to emergencies, promoting peace and reconciliation, and long-term development to empower local communities. One of the expanding areas of work which permeates all Caritas programmes, especially in the developing world, is HIV/AIDS ministry. Across Africa, as in other parts of the globe, the Catholic Church provides around one quarter of all the prevention, care and support programmes for individuals, families and communities affected by HIV and AIDS. Father Bob Vitillo is Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS to the Caritas Confederation. He's just produced a new pastoral training manual on the specific Catholic response to the challenges of this pandemic.
Well, this is a training manual, a pastoral training manual on responding to HIV and AIDS. It's actually a second edition. We had a Caritas training manual that was published by the Daughters of St. Paul in Africa in 1996. And the sisters told me that there were many requests for it, but after 10 years, it really needed to be updated. So we did a second edition, but this is much expanded. We've learned a great deal about HIV and AIDS during the last 10 years. And we also have a lot more best practices that we could feature of the church's response to AIDS. But then also there's a much more intensive focus on pastoral accompaniment and support. Because I find that more and more we really still need to continue our programs of training clergy and religious on the spiritual and the pastoral aspects of responding to AIDS.
If you talk about the amount that we've learned, as you say, over the past decade or so, what do you think are the most significant issues that you're dealing with in this manual?
Well, certainly we've learned a great deal about how the virus works, although we still haven't learned how to stop it from working anymore. But also then we do have the antiretroviral treatments that help to prolong life and bring about a better quality of life for many people. So this is reflected certainly in the manual. Also, there's a great deal that's reflected on the advocacy that's necessary, on working with governments to make sure that we have universal access to treatment, support, care, and prevention for all people who need it, and not just for those who can afford it.
As you say, the advance in antiretroviral medicines has been enormous, has made a huge difference, but not so much in Africa, where the disease is still concentrated, isn't it?
We now have at least 2 million people from developing countries on these medications, and that's a great advance compared to past years.
But well below the targets you'd set yourself.
Well below the targets, yes, and that's the point. The impact of the medications is very clear in the communities where people are getting access, they're living longer, they're going back to work, they're taking care of their children, we're avoiding producing more orphans that way. But we need many, many more places to be able to get access to the medications.
When you're talking about funding, the last time I saw you, you were talking about this vast network of care and prevention programs that the church particularly is doing, not only in Africa, but the lack of funding that reflects the great work that's being done.
Yes, this is still a problem. Certainly, I think that in many of our church donor agencies, including many Caritases from the north, are trying their best to support programs. But when you look at the size of the problem, there's no way that we could be able to provide all the funding that's necessary from our own church funds. But we still have to do more. But then we have to find the ways to access the global fund support, the government support for these programs. The church is performing maybe one quarter of all of the AIDS work in the world, and yet we certainly don't get one quarter of all the money that's being sent out there for HIV and AIDS.
This is still a very political issue, though, isn't it? I mean, how do you manage to negotiate your way, if you like, through this complex world of the political issues surrounding the funding debate?
Well, in all advocacy, I think so much of it is based both on clear information, on persistent information, but then also on building relationships. And so one of the reasons why Caritas asked me to be based in Geneva was to build those relationships with the global agencies, with UNAIDS, with the World Health Organization, with the Global Fund. The Global Fund works mainly through country coordinating mechanisms, and so when I go to them and say, we need more money for the church programs, they say, well, we can't do that from here in Geneva. It's up to the country where the programs are being sponsored. But little by little, I've worked with other groups of church agencies and other non-governmental organizations, and we now have a new guidance that's been put out by the board of the Global Fund to those country coordinating mechanisms that they should at least be willing to have both a proposal from the government itself, but also from civil society. So that will open up a little more the possibilities of the church being able to access some of that money.
The book and the work that you're doing is focused very much around giving people and communities hope where AIDS had somehow destroyed that hope. Does that continue to be perhaps the key message that you're trying to put across?
Certainly a key message to bring across, that there is hope, and I think this is very much in keeping with our Christian outlook on things, Christian optimism, no matter how much suffering we have, even to the point of death, as Jesus died on the cross, he rose from the dead. And that's our perspective as Christians. So yes, to bring hope to people through this work. But then also, I have to say that in my own ministry in this area, I receive hope by finding people that in the midst of terrible suffering, terrible illness, terrible loss, they still hold on to this hope in God, and they are grounded to the grace that they receive from God. And I think we need to tell that message. That's preaching the gospel in a very practical way.
Father Bob Vitillo is Special Advisor to the Caritas Confederation on HIV and AIDS. Another focus of this Caritas Internationalis General Assembly is that of caring for people affected by the world's forgotten conflicts. While media attention focuses on some war-torn parts of the globe, making it relatively easy to find funding for the victims, other countries endure years, even decades, of war, violence and oppression far away from the international spotlight. Somalia is one of those countries where civil war and anarchy have devastated the Horn of Africa nation for over 16 years, leaving hundreds of thousands displaced and almost three-quarters of the population suffering from undernourishment. Recent weeks of mounting violence in and around the capital Mogadishu have led to UN leaders warning of the worst humanitarian crisis the country has ever seen. My colleague Susie Hodges spoke to Davide Bernocchi, head of Caritas in Somalia, to find out more about the current upsurge in fighting there.
From one side, you have the feeling that Ethiopians, although they are not really appreciated by Somalis, but they are bringing back a bit of security, stability, at least outside Mogadishu, I would say. Mogadishu is a particular case. But then, what is happening is that since the insurgents, those who oppose the government, don't have any space to express, I would say, themselves, but on the violence level, they are actually starting terroristic actions. This was expected. This was expectable, at least, if not expected. And this is, to me, also the evidence that a certain militaristic approach to the war on terror is actually creating terrorism.
Do people there feel that proponents or sympathizers of Al-Qaeda are very much active in Somalia?
I don't know whether we can speak about Al-Qaeda. For sure, there is a very strong Islamist component in Somalia. And in the Somali context, these people were just looking for a political role to play in Somalia. Since the international community was not able to avoid the war, of course, also within, I would say, the Islamist environment, the most extremist and violent wing took the lead. Now, the political wing of Islamists is marginalized in this moment.
It's the extremists who have got the upper hand.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
How would you describe the morale of the people, you know, given, as you say, this deteriorating security situation, this worsening violence, you know, these suicide bomb attacks in Mogadishu?
Islamists have been able to ensure a certain stability in Mogadishu for 6 months and to give people concrete results in terms of changes of daily life. Now I think that Somalis, after 16 years of civil war, Somalis want and expect concrete results. So they are going to judge this government on concrete results. And I think that within the government there is somehow the awareness that now the humanitarian war has to be won after the military one. But on the other side, to do this, we need an inclusive process. We need to put back the point of the situation on the political table.
Yes, when you go around and you talk to ordinary Somali people, I mean, are they pessimistic about the immediate future? I mean, what are their feelings? What are they saying to you?
They say it's good to have a government. It's not good to have Ethiopians. Ethiopians are the traditional historical enemies of Somalis. So a government backed and finally imposed by the Ethiopian army will never be accepted in Somalia. So I think it is very important at this moment to ensure the conditions for the government to work, but Ethiopians are not the most appropriate people to do it.
Turning to the humanitarian situation, the UN says that nearly three quarters of the Somali population is undernourished. So is it a real battle to get food or to find an adequate diet?
I would say more the second. In many regions, it's different finding food itself. In other regions, food is available, but not an adequate diet. We also know that one out of four children dies before reaching 5 years. So the humanitarian situation is really terrible.
In fact, the UN says that Somalia is currently undergoing its worst humanitarian crisis of the last 15, 16 years. Is that your impression as well?
I think so, because of the compounding effect of different problems. In the last year, only in the last year, we had drought, then floods, then cholera, war. All these things, of course, have worsened the already precarious situation.
How many people have been displaced from their homes, and how are they coping? Who's looking after them?
According to UNHCR, almost 400,000 people have been displaced from Mogadishu between March and April, when the last clashes between Ethiopian troops and government troops from one side and insurgents from the other side took place. Now the problem is that some members of the international community have accused the government not to ensure humanitarian access to the IDPs, and that is already a big problem in itself. And then many quarters have been totally destroyed, so it is actually a big problem also to think how these people will be able to go back to Mogadishu. So for now they are scattered in their traditional areas where their clans are living, but these areas are mostly desertic areas which are not able to support and to provide for their livelihood.
So you're saying that many of these people, as you say, the aid agencies cannot reach, and so really don't really know what their plight's like.
Yes, I would say so. Although emergencies of this kind in Somalia tend to have a very brief life, because Somalis are used to live in emergency, they can also adapt quite well, or better than other people, maybe. And they also have their own internal clan solidarity mechanism that help a lot in these cases.
But tell me something specifically about what Caritas is doing, I mean, how you're helping the needy people.
The Caritas network, so which is broader than Caritas Somalia, has been present in Somalia throughout the civil war. So in this moment we have Caritas Switzerland operating in Hargeisa, in the self-declared independent region of Somaliland. Then we have Troker, which is Caritas Ireland, working in Gedo region and providing health. Caritas Somalia is working in Baidoa, the town which is hosting the transitional federal institutions at the moment, although some of them have already relocated into Mogadishu. And what we do is basically health, in the sense that although the city has a key role on a political level, there is basically nothing. I mean, no infrastructures. On a humanitarian and social level, it's really a disaster. So we answered an appeal launched by the government almost 1 year and a half ago, and we established a health center in Baidoa, in which we treated more than 36,000 people in the last year.
Now, there has been calls for an international reconciliation effort, but nothing's really come of that. I mean, again, do people think that this will get off the ground?
It's a political initiative by the president, and there has been a lot of debate whether it would include also Islamists or not. And of course, also the international community is playing a role in this. What I would say is that as long as these Congress will be able to include not only all the clan elements, but also all the different political positions represented within the Somali society, there is a hope that Somalia will find a path towards peace, as long as neighboring countries relinquish the will to control directly the political destiny of Somalia.
It's known that the US, though, supports Ethiopia and is very anxious that the Islamists should not gain too much of a hold in Somalia. Is that also causing resentment in the local population?
Well, I think that what is causing resentment in the local population are more the military actions that America made directly, once in the south and once few days ago in the north. I mean, bombarding a village because you think there might be a terrorist there, it's not acceptable, it's not legal, and of course causes resentment, and just, I think, ensures a broader support for Islamists.
Susie Hodges talking there to Davide Bernocchi, head of Caritas in Somalia. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. We'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. Don't forget you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.